Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dolores Hartley filling in for Tanya Mack, who's traveling today. Tanya and our old nursing colleagues and friends. And we're very excited to have with us today three guests. And I'll start with Dr. David Rye, who is a internationally known and respected researcher and leader in sleep studies. He's with Emory, and he's currently a professor of neurology there at the hospital, at the university, who specializes in hypersomnia, narcolepsy, restless leg syndrome, and other sleep disorders. And today's topic is going to be focused on hypersomnia. Welcome, Dr. Rye.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being with us. Dr. Rye is a graduate of the University of Chicago School of Medicine. He has done residency in neurology, PhD in neurobiology, board certified in psychiatry and neurology, and doing the research work here now at university. So a lot of information to share with us today. So we're really excited to have you. We also have with us Lloyd Johnson, who is visiting with us from Australia, Perth to be exact, and he is a patient advocate with the Hypersomnia Foundation. And we also have Kat Rye with us, who is the co-founder of the Hypersomnia Foundation. So lots of great information to share. So I'll let you get us started, Dr. Rye, and tell us how you became interested in the field of sleep disorders and how we came to where we are with hypersomnia today.
Well, there's a long and a short story, and I think probably this is better for the short story. Is part of my thesis work was on a part of the brain that was involved in the control of sleep, and very early on, so that was the early 90s, I realized that there was a dearth of physicians that specialized in problems of sleep and wake related to the brain regions that control sleep and wake. And from there, became quite interested in essentially, as a neurologist, we're often trained about content of consciousness, speech, thinking, cognition, and very little effort was really put on to, you know, just what's responsible for turning the lights on that morning. More real basic, you know, are the lights on? Are the lights going off? And what controls those systems as opposed to what controls the content of what makes us human, so to speak?
Well, we appreciate your curiousness, for sure. I can remember as a nurse when we first opened sleep labs and how foreign that subject even seemed to us. But the field has just grown exponentially over the last couple of decades. So describe for us, what is hypersomnia?
Well, I think if we break down the definition of hypersomnia and look at it, I recently looked it up in the Oxford Medical Dictionary, and it basically is a disorder characterized by too much sleep. And I think many of us are familiar with maybe coworkers or family members that we see fall asleep in a meeting or pass off. That's really a momentary situation where you can say that person's sleepy, but you really don't know over 24 hours how much that person is actually slept. And I think there's been a lot of emphasis and literature and attention to things like narcolepsy, where people fall asleep quickly and are sort of called narcoleptic, almost in common parlance. But here's a situation where patients sleep too much, and trying to capture that complaint, measure it, and see how it affects their lives, mostly negatively, is a challenge to us. But certainly there's many of these patients out there. They're very silent in terms of how they may be seen by other doctors or in which doctors they encounter. Frequently misdiagnosed as depression or chronic fatigue or just being lazy. And we're starting to understand more and more about the causes of hypersomnia, so that this knowledge has to come out.
Well, I think I'll go over to Lloyd here, who might be able, as a in his personal experience, to share a little bit more with the audience about his personal battle with this condition.
Yeah. Thank you. And one of the things as a patient is it's very easy from the outside for people to look at this disorder and think it's a sleep disorder, and the problem stops when you're awake. But as a patient, that's when the problem really starts.
Okay.
I get this horrible, horrible feeling when I wake up, and the doctors call it sleep drunkenness. But it's not like being a little tipsy, it's like being totally drunk. I just can't keep my eyes open, I'm uncoordinated, and if I'm able to lie in bed for like half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, it will gradually pass. But if you said, right, there's a fire alarm going off, get up, get out of bed, like I couldn't coordinate myself properly. And so when you think about it, when you're sleeping like more than 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and then it takes you an hour just to sort of get through that brain fog, it's got a huge impact. And it's never really gone. So it affects conversations, it affects your social life, it affects your ability to be present at work. And I mean, like in a lot of severe cases, the doctors just say, nope, that's it, you can't drive anymore.
Wow.
And it's hard to sort of sum that up, just talking about sleeping a lot.
Well, just thinking of, you're talking 10 to 15 hours out of a 24-hour period, that alone is a huge chunk right there when you're discussing that.
Yeah.
So,
well, just do the math. By the time you've showered, eaten, like gone for a little bit of a walk, like there's your day gone.
You're right.
Yeah.
So carry us back here, Dr. Ryan. What's the difference between primary and secondary causes of hypersomnia?
Well, we could talk about it here. I'm not sure that's been codified by our, the sleep experts, so to speak. Secondary would be thinking about causes that might contribute to somebody manifesting too much sleep. So if I don't let you sleep for a couple nights, or, you know, you only get to sleep 4 hours for three or four nights in a row, you're going to want to get that sleep back. And if I capture you in the Kodak moment 3 days later, you'll probably sleep 12 hours or 13 hours. I think many of us can relate to that, either with a long travel or just a hectic schedule over 3 or 4 days. We catch up and we need to. That's important. So that's hypersomnia.
Okay.
For that restricted period of time, but we can point to a cause. You've sleep deprived yourself or sleep restricted yourself. There's many other causes that have been associated with the symptom of hypersomnia, but I would get back to what I sort of introduced this with. How does one measure it, and has it really been measured? If you can think about it, how difficult would that be to do? If we were going to definitely say you were asleep, we'd have to have electrodes on your forehead and on your scalp and say, yes, she slept for 12 hours straight. Now, who practically is going to do that, and who's going to reimburse for it? So for many disorders that I think the listeners and other folks can relate to, if our thyroid hormones are low, if we have hypothyroidism, I had it at one time. I slept Christmas vacation away 12, 13 hours a day. But has anybody ever measured that and reported it in a medical journal? No. It's common parlance to a physician that low thyroid can manifest as hypersomnia, but no one's ever documented it. We don't know how many people. So that's what we can think of some secondary causes. Another very common one in this population that's important to think about, because many of our patients, probably a slight majority are women, young women, is iron deficiency. And iron deficiency is very common in premenopausal women. It's present in probably 1 in 3 of them. So has anybody bothered measuring that sleepiness or hypersomnia in that patient group? And the answer is no. So again, there's many things that when you go to a regular primary care physician and mention, they may check and they do the check off. Okay, they're not hypothyroid, they're not anemic, and they usually don't check iron. They just check get your blood count. You can still be iron deficient without being anemic. Common fallacy there. And there's a couple other things. If your adrenal gland doesn't work, you can have hypersomnia, or at least what sounds like it. Again, it hasn't been documented that they sleep, excessively. It's just a word of mouth, so to speak, right? I mean, so those would be secondary causes, and then we can think of sleep disorders themselves, things that are common that many of the listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with, things like obstructive sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Patients will wake up tired, unrefreshed, maybe be in bed a longer time than usual and still be sleepy during the day, and that's an identifiable but secondary cause. If that's fixed, that symptom gets better. Restless legs, possibly, but that may be related to the restriction of sleep but mm-hmm. caused by the symptoms of restless legs. Once we've ruled out all those and we make sure the patients aren't taking medications, many medications make us sleepy. Just think of over-the-counter cold medicines. I mean, those will make you foggy and groggy. Once we've ruled out all those, we're left with quote-unquote primary hypersomnia, or hypersomnia that seems to arise sui generis from a disorder of the central nervous system. And I think that's where we've made the greatest strides at the moment in terms of our recent discoveries and treatments. And we'd love to talk about those.
Well, you led right into that beautifully. So carry us right into where you are with your research now.
Well, we in the sleep field have seen these patients for many a long period of time, and we can certainly have our ways of labeling them and measuring them and putting them in a box and clustering mm-hmm. them together. But the real question remains, how do we treat them? And is there a reason, is there a logical, rational treatment algorithm to treat them? And the simple answer right now is no. There's no FDA-approved treatments. FDA-approved treatments for treating, quote-unquote, sleepiness, and I would going back to the distinction, sleepiness and hypersomnia are really two different things. They can coexist, but they're different. There's many medications that are approved to treat narcolepsy. And those medicines are the default medicines that are used to treat hypersomnia. Medications such as amphetamine derivatives, so these traditional psychostimulants, speed, so to mm-hmm. speak, in common parlance. And the analogy or metaphor we use, my colleagues and I use, is this is like pushing the gas pedal when you need to go faster. It's essentially assuming that the brain can't stay awake. So what we do is we give it wake chemicals. We give it chemicals and neurotransmitter signaling molecules that enhance wakefulness. And we did this for many, many years to moderate success, if and certainly in some patients, no success. So we've had patients taking 100 milligrams of amphetamine a day plus additional things to help them stay awake. What we eventually, after seeing this over and over and over again in a subgroup of people, we said, we are not thinking about this correctly. I mean, maybe it's time to kind of look at it a different way. And a lot of colleagues that I worked with, we were fortunate enough to be in an environment and have some time to say, gosh, maybe this is not a problem of staying awake. Maybe the problem is that the sleep system is too jacked up. These patients have a problem with the parking brake on. So you can push the gas pedal all you want, but if the parking brake's engaged and the sleep system is overactive, they're not going to benefit from these medications. Okay, they're not going to benefit from caffeine. They're not going to benefit from amphetamines. And that's kind of how it started, and then a logical progression in terms of trying to identify the parking brake, and it seems like we have a pretty reasonable idea of what the parking brake is and how to basically release the parking brake.
And that's what you're involved in the deep research right now, is my understanding, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So, and I understand that there's some keys there in doing some cerebral spinal fluid mm-hmm. testing, so...
Right. So we thought that the major chemical that is essentially involved in sleep and anesthesia uh-huh. is a chemical called gamma-aminobutyric acid. And this is, for the short acronym, is GABA, G-A-B-A. and that we learn about, and medications that are used for anesthesia, isoflurane, propofol, act by enhancing this natural GABA in the brain. And pharmaceutical companies have taken advantage of this knowledge to also make drugs that they use for conscious sedation, whatever that is. Maybe it was what Lloyd was talking about, conscious sedation. I mean, there, talk about a oxymoron, huh?
Right.
So agents that you would undergo a colonoscopy, so that drug is Versed.
Right.
Or midazolam also works through enhancing GABA. So there's many, many drugs. Valium, all the common sleeping pills that are prescribed all work through GABA. So to us, it was sort of like, let's try looking at GABA first and see if there is some enhancement of the system. And essentially what we found was that in patients that have primary hypersomnia, again, and we've ruled out all these secondary causes, and had not responded to traditional, you know, push the gas pedal approaches, that in their spinal fluid in the presence together with GABA made GABA more effective. So it was like an enhancing molecule in the spinal fluid that we could see and measure. And because there's a nice little agent available to wake people up from anesthesia, or if you've swallowed mom's, you know, prescriptions of Valium, it's called flumazenil, and it's a beautiful antidote to reverse the effects of too much GABA. So when we did the experiments in a dish with the patient's spinal fluid, we saw the spinal fluid enhance GABA's effects. And then when we took flumazenil in the dish, did it outside the person first, we were able to reverse it.
Wow.
In the dish. And we said, well, geez, if it works in the dish, you know, maybe we should try it in humans. And, you know, the story's unfolding from there. It's taking off like wildfire. It seems to be a good approach in carefully selected patients at the moment. And, you know, we're still working on, you know, who would most benefit, how can we do it faster, how can we identify these people quicker, how can we get other sources of flumazenil, what's the best way to give it, and that's where we're at.
Is there a brand name for flumazenil?
Well, it's generic now, so
okay.
At the time, it's referred to as flumazenil, but the original manufacturer was Roche from Switzerland, and it was called Ramazicon.
Okay.
Sounds very intergalactical.
It does. And it almost sounds like you've got finding this particular enzyme. You were talking about conscious sedation. It was a self-induced, your body was naturally conscious sedating
you. One of the great, I thought, headlines when we first reported this that came out when the media covered it was, I think the headline in one report was putting oneself to sleep. And I think that's...
Wow.
That probably captures it right there, that headline.
Well, I'm going to jump over here to Kat now, let her talk a little bit about how are we helping those patients out there, possibly through the foundation here.
Okay, so the Hypersomnia Foundation has been created as part of understanding the needs to educate and to help the patient's advocate and to also fundraise for future scientific discovery. So when the foundation is created, many, many people feel like they're the only ones with this, that their doctors are telling them that, you know, different diagnoses that are probably inaccurate, and they're just feeling kind of alone out there in the world. Mm-hmm. And so we would like to, you know, bring people together as a blog. I know that Lloyd's created this blog through Living with Hypersomnia. And the Hypersomnia Foundation also wants to put together, be a collection point of information, medical papers, any kind of information that these patients can take to their doctors and help them understand that there's new discoveries happening with hypersomnia. And then the other thing, like I say, is to do fundraising to help along future medical research.
Yeah, the research. Mm-hmm. The critical point.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
So, how are you spreading the word out to the physicians that are out there possibly seeing the patients? How are we getting that information to them?
There's traditional ways, which is us, slogging away in the few few wee hours of the night that we have when we're not taking care of patients to write these things up and get them distributed in, peer-reviewed journals so physicians can see it. We've presented information at medical conferences and sleep conferences and have been incredibly well-received. One thing we haven't talked about yet, which is a really interesting sort of serendipitous finding in this, was the index case that most of the original work came from is here in Atlanta. And she was taking flumazenil for quite some time, doing quite well, got back to work. She was actually on family and medical leave and got back to work, became partnered at her law firm. That's a great clinical outcome.
Yes.
And was doing quite well and stable, and her primary care physician decided when she had an upper respiratory infection and some bronchitis to prescribe her clarithromycin, old-fashioned bioxin, one of the mycin drugs. And we got a phone call within 24 hours that she couldn't sleep. And those are the sorts of things you can either ignore or you can follow up on. And when we followed up on it, it turned out it was like taking an overdose of flumazenil. In our experimental system, clarithromycin did the same thing that flumazenil did in a dish. So we've actually done some clinical trials because that's a much more available drug, widely available medication that's approved and easy to get and generic. And we've done a double label controlled trial of clarithromycin, worked, and we just published an open label experience with 53 people. So we've probably treated over 100 people with clarithromycin.
Wow.
One that I saw this morning just coming on here from clinic, and she wants to stay on it. She was on Adderall and says, nope, this worked better.
So this is an actual antibiotic.
Yeah.
That is mimicking the effects there.
Of flumazenil. It's a side effect.
And
these patients seems to be a wanted side effect, right? So last year at the International Sleep Meeting, we presented that information, and I've been going to that meeting for 20 years, and it's the first time I've seen a lecture hall standing room only. I had to crawl over people myself to get a seat.
Well, the interest and knowing the need is out there, too. I can imagine that that's...
Well, I think that's a big part of this collective effort of everyone here is the unmet clinical need is probably enormous.
Yes.
People constantly are asking us, well, how frequent do you think this is? And I'm like, I think one thing that's really important for people listening and physicians in general is patients, they walk in different doorways. Oftentimes, there's no rhyme or reason to what doorway they ask. But, they've come to realize there's a problem, and they may not know which physician is the best physician to handle it. And,
yeah.
and the words they use, unfortunately, depending on the physician, the old adage, if you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So.
That's right.
Some people get labeled fatigue. Some people get labeled depressed. They may be hypersomnia. I just don't know. So I can't give you an accurate number. And that's something I think that's really sorely needed. So if we can come up with a much quicker way than getting spinal fluid to measure it in a fairly, proprietary test or time-consuming at least, and be able to come out with estimates quickly, we'd be able to answer that question and I think impact the world faster and more efficiently.
Well, being able, like you say, to measure and being invasive in the spinal fluid, is that one of the key components of your research at this point?
Well, that's something that we is and may not be so easy to do. As I was quoted in one article or interview previously, it's I think many of us know NCIS, and Abby goes over to her little mass spec machine and pushes a button and comes back in a half hour. and she's got the answer of everything that's in the unknown sample.
Exactly.
It's not quite so easy. When you were dealing with brain chemicals, I remember when I was a student, the starting point was the slaughterhouse. You used to have to get large quantities of brain, and the best place and cheapest place to do that was go down to 159th mm-hmm. Street in Chicago and get calf brains and start to isolate chemicals, and you have to start with a large quantity. So, there's a lot of practical issues that have to be sorted out. But certainly if we can get our hands on it and figure that out, it's going to be a dramatically change the game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, this is just too fascinating. I'm just absolutely amazed. And I want to go ahead and any other comments that Lloyd you'd like to make?
Yeah, this has been one of the invaluable parts of the Hypersomnia Foundation's work is I'm sitting in Australia and I become aware of this research coming out of Georgia about flumazenil. And my doctors are going, oh, you're just depressed or you're lazy or you're staying out too late. And anyway, this information came out about clarithromycin and I went into my doctor's office in Australia, Western Australia, 11,000 miles. I've flown that. And I said, I want to try this clarithromycin. And he said, you've got to be kidding me, right?
Yeah.
There is no way. He's looking at me. He's going, we're giving you as many amphetamines as you want. And you're asking me for an antibiotic? So anyway, he says, come back in a week. I'm going to read all the literature. I go back in a week. He puts me on clarithromycin. And there's videos of this on YouTube. And within a week, I was waking up. I was waking up better than I would wake up with huge doses of Ritalin, huge doses of dexamphetamine, without the teeth grinding, without my blood pressure shooting through the roof. That's just amazing.
It is amazing.
Well,
it
tell her what's happened after that. Lloyd's story is just fascinating. I mean,
yeah.
So the big problem with flumazenil is it's normally for people who are anaesthetized. So they can't take a tablet. You can't afford to hang around for that to be dissolved. So it's all IV only.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was looking around in Australia for this stuff. And I found this center treating drug addicts who are addicted to benzodiazepine sleeping tablets. And they had all this flumazenil sitting in their back room ready to treat people addicted to sleeping tablets. So I rang them up. And I said, look, I don't have a problem with sleeping tablets, but I've got this hypersomnia. And that once again, they pulled out all the literature that had come out of Emory University, and they said, we'll give this a try. Now, when I went down there for the first appointment, I was expecting there to be all this resistance and let's go really slowly.
Uh-huh.
That afternoon, I walked out of there with a pump connected to me, infusing flumazenil into the subcutaneous tissue.
Oh, my goodness.
And, this is a completely different way to what they've done with the studies. At Emory, they've used lozenges sublingually. Uh-huh. But lo and behold, I was on YouTube later that night, and I was waking up.
Wow.
A week later, I was back driving a car. My doctor had said, you can't drive. This is a progressive disorder. You may never be able to drive again. I went out, and I bought a push bike. I can't tell you.
Lloyd, you may have to tell the American audience what a push bike is.
A bicycle.
Bicycle.
yeah.
Wow.
And I walked into the psychiatrist's office, and he was convinced I had depression. And he just had to do a double take. He was like, who is this guy? But it was the old Lloyd. This is who I am. The hypersomnia turned me into this sleepy-haired, foggy-brained, bumbling dude.
So when did your symptoms occur? What age were you, and what's the age range there?
They first started occurring for me when I was 14.
14.
So a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And
The typical age of onset is teens or late teens, and that's a problem in and of itself, right?
Because they start sleeping a lot.
Correct. How many times have I heard you're in a growth spurt, right? You're tired, you're sleepy. But there's a natural tendency for teenagers to sleep more. And narcolepsy, genuine, real narcolepsy, starts at the same age.
Oh, wow.
So you've got enough ignorance about what it is. But then you've got in that age group, if the patient shows up at that age, you've got these other common things that are in people's minds in their physician's training, and they think about those first before they think about death. So again, when, you know, people ask me, and unfortunately the sleep field says this is a rare disorder, and I in the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? I mean, you know, it's almost a moral imperative that you can't go around saying something doesn't exist if you can't measure it.
True. Absolutely.
And we've got this Facebook group. This time last year, it didn't exist. And now it's fastly approaching 1,200 people. And not one of those people has turned up and said, I went to my doctor, I described my symptoms, and he said, this is what I think I have. They turn up and they go, I got told at 21 that I'm depressed and I'm 45 and I've been struggling with this for my whole life and I finally found this information and, whoa, I think this is what I have.
Wow. How did you connect with Emory other than through your research? How did you connect with Dr. Ryan, the foundation?
Through the Hypersomnia Foundation.
Okay.
They put out some articles about Anna Somers, who was the first person to really use flumazenil long term. And it was through those articles that I heard about it.
That's terrific.
There you go. You got to communicate, right?
Communicate. Facebook.
Like we're doing here, right?
That's right. YouTube. Now, understand we have a conference or a symposium coming up in the next week with the Hypersomnia Foundation.
We do. A couple of us got together and said, well, how about we, you know, primarily we were thinking more for the local people. Get together and have a conference and, you know, like I say, educate, advocate, and, you know, hopefully raise some funds for medical research. And so we thought, well, maybe we'll get, you know, 20, 25 to come. And so we'll kind of put it out there to the blog and see where it goes. So we've got people coming from all over the United States of America, 140 to be exact. We've got someone from Australia. We've got someone from France, Canada. So, and this is the first one. And this was literally put out to the crowd, I think just right after the first of the year.
Wow.
So it's the first one. It's baby steps. But, you know, next year it'll be greater. And just really getting that awareness out is what it's all about.
That's the key. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So anything we haven't touched on that you want to bring to the audience before we close today?
thank you for your time and inviting us. These are some of the most grateful patients that you can possibly imagine treating, and just seeing how quickly you can make a difference as a physician in someone's life is really dramatic, especially some of the younger folks that we have had that have been out of school, can't work,
right.
Getting them back into the real world has just been so gratifying to me. And Lloyd's been a huge inspiration to me, too, I can tell
you.
Keeping up with this guy, especially with the 15-hour time difference, makes me run around the clock. But it's become a worldwide effort. I got an email today from somebody in France, a colleague, and we're referred patients from all over the United States from, you know, very famous places. But you know, it's happening, and that's great.
That is great. Now, I wanted to ask you, you're doing the research and you're teaching. Now, if patients were interested in getting some more information or contacting a physician, where would we direct them?
Well, the foundation page is good, livingwithhypersomnia.com, the hypersomniafoundation.org, which we're busy kind of trying to get up to speed. Emory's sleep.emory.edu will get you entered into the Emory system and the information available there and how to get an appointment to see me. We're actually don't necessarily believe that just because people teach and research they don't see patients. I actually see patients about half of the time.
That's terrific. I didn't know if you did or did not. So,
and I think that may be one reason this was discovered here and not somewhere else, because we actually do see patients. We listen to them very carefully, and that's if you patients. I usually try to emphasize to my doctors in training always are telling you what the problem is. And the real problem in translation isn't the patient.
It's the listening ear.
It's usually the listener that the where the problem exists. So we view patience as very, you know, instructive to us and what it's all about. I mean, after all.
Well, that's great. And again, you're listening to Dr. David Rye, who's director of research for Emory Healthcare's program in sleep. And so he's given you some great contacts here, and we've been so privileged to have all of you with us today. And we congratulate you on your findings and wish you much success as you grow and learn more. Thank you for being here with us from Australia.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we hope we'll have you back in the future. We'll hear some more good news. We'd love to have you. And I want to say, everybody, thank you for listening today. And please help us recognize our sponsor at www.healthgate.com. Check it out for offers or products that may save you time and money. And enjoy your afternoon, Atlanta.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.